Hold your head as high as you can, high enough to see who you are, little man. Life sometimes is cold and cruel, maybe no one else will tell you, so remember that you are black gold, black gold. You are.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kathy Bostrom from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Oprah. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Daily. How we create magic in our everyday lives. Readers share their tiny rituals, by Cassie Hurwitz. Our days are filled with routine: commuting, school drop-off and pickup, cooking the same five dinners the whole family will eat. The ad nauseum of it all can be numbing. Even when we break out of it for a weekend at the beach or a good friend's wedding, it's right back to the grind afterward. But does it have to be? Are there ways to sprinkle a little magic into your waking hours? Novelty is excellent for your brain, after all. We asked Oprah Daily newsletter subscribers how they do it, and they delivered. These many, many ideas aren't time-consuming or challenging, just small, easy ways to inject some whimsy and newness into this thing we call life. Try some magical thinking. Creativity is my everyday salvation. I talk to my pets, my plants, and my keys when I misplace them in the morning, calling out loud, "All right, keys, this isn't funny. Where are you hiding?" Typically, as if by magic, they appear, further fueling my wild imagination and playful approach to life. Donna A. Getting to work every morning is a one-hour drive, swarmed in traffic moving at the speed of a snail. I'll fetch new ideas for my novel from the bridges and the maze of traffic. The magic created in every moment breaks the ho-hum of my routine. Poonam S. Before I open my eyes, I picture tall, gentle, tree-trunk-like beings on either side of me, with pulleys lifting me into the day. I visualize myself strutting a fashion runway, selecting the perfect outfit for whatever lies ahead. When life feels too heavy, I return to a shimmering, gemstone-lined cave in my mind, a place of quiet magic and strength. Arvinder S. Spoil yourself for no reason at all. On the way home from work, I'll stop and buy fresh flowers from my kitchen island or ingredients to bake a new dessert. Even the idea of getting a new magazine makes me happy. Amaral O. Who needs Starbucks when I've mastered the art of the frothy home latte? My coffee station, born in the quiet of the pandemic, still brings me joy. Each sip a tiny triumph. Dinner time means music that matches the mood. Bossa nova plus pasta equals chef's kiss. And my office door? It's covered in postcards I mailed myself as a reminder. Yes, you were there. Yes, it mattered. And yes, this joy was real and still is. Amy B. Every night after dinner, my partner and I play a gummy bear guessing game to make our sweet treats a little more fun. He'll pull one out from the bag, keeping it hidden from me, and I'll try to guess what flavor it's going to be. It only works with the 12 flavor packs. We go 3 for 3 and keep a tally of who's in the lead. I'm winning. Kira K. I try to do one fun thing a day. It doesn't have to be anything big or expensive. It can be a swim at the local pool, a walk down the wooded trail at the end of my street, playing a few rounds of Wordle with my husband, eating lunch outside even if it's a bit cold. It makes a difference. Colleen C. Plan a jolt of joy. I have two of those smart bird feeders with cameras set up in my parents' yard in Maine. It's a tiny boost of joy to check out the cardinals, hummingbirds, and more who stop by throughout the day. Polly D. I'm spending a few weeks with my daughter and her family in Ghana. In the mornings, I listen to the twitter of birds, especially the ones only found in this part of the world. What makes my day is the hug my grandson gives me. He looks straight in my eyes with a loving smile, and it fills me with delight. Lada G. Whenever I'm waiting for my cup of joe to brew in the morning, I do about 20 squats. It gives me a quick shot of adrenaline and helps my brain wake up, and it brightens my mood. Witsy. When my baby girl was a newborn, I started singing Feeling Good by Nina Simone to her first thing in the morning when I changed her diaper. It became a daily ritual that helped me have a happy start to the day no matter how exhausted. I play with her legs and sing, da 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 da, da 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 da, and she still giggles at two. I'm a lucky, lucky older mom at 48, and this morning joy is so sweet. Rafina H. After a really hard day in law school, I walked to the travel agency and asked for a brochure on the Orient Express. Just turning the glossy pages made my blood pressure go down. Now, when I need a break, I Google glorious aspirational vacations for 5 to 10 minutes. I just choose a place I'd like to visit someday and start searching for luxury properties. It's travel window shopping. Angela T. Dance like nobody's watching. I'm an empty nester with a demanding corporate job. I like my work and my colleagues, but the daily routine does get a little monotonous. To spice things up, I sign up for dance classes so that I'm always learning something new and meeting new people of all ages. I get to wear fun dance shoes and outfits, and I get to dance to great music. I just finished a tap series and am now starting ballroom dance, hoping to learn shuffle dancing next. Stacy C. I work for DoorDash part-time. I dance and sing when I'm out and about doing deliveries. It's invigorating and contagious. People tend to smile, nod their heads, or join in. It's a great way to break up the monotony. Denise. As soon as I get home from work, I kick off my shoes, turn up my favorite dance tunes, and have a 15-minute solo jam session in front of a full-length mirror. It's my daily dose of joy, movement, and pure silliness. A playful ritual that instantly lifts my spirits and reconnects me with my most carefree self. Kendra N. Embrace mischief. Sometimes at work, when I'm walking through my school building and someone is walking behind me, I'll turn the corner and run about 15 to 20 yards and then resume my walking pace, just to freak them out when they turn the corner. It makes me giggle every time. Jana L. My husband and I leave booby traps for each other. Today he rested our son's lunchbox on top of the fridge, so when I opened the fridge, it landed on my head. Rashti. When I was growing up, my mom did this every evening without fail. When she heard the garage door open, she'd go into my dad's study and hide under the desk. He'd walk in there to put down his work bag, and she'd jump out to surprise him and say, "Boo." It wasn't a surprise after the first few times, but it always delighted them both. Jenny T. That was How We Create Magic in Our Everyday Lives by Cassie Hurwitz. Word of the week. Negging. Flirty banter is fun until it takes a sinister turn. By Cassie Hurwitz. There's nothing like the rush of flirting. That effervescent, giddy feeling, it's a treat. But there's a dangerous form of flirting on the rise in teens and young adults, especially those dialed into the manosphere, that makes the receiver feel flattened rather than elated, and it's called negging. It's a form of emotional manipulation that appears as a backhanded compliment or subtle insult, explains Robin Stern, Ph.D., a psychoanalyst co-founder of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence and author of The Gaslight Effect. If someone says, without sarcasm or irony, "Wow, you actually look pretty today," or "I'm surprised you had such a smart idea," you're being negged. It may feel like the adult version of a middle schooler purposefully bumping your shoulder while passing you in the hall. "Ooh, I think he likes me." That's because negging is designed to bother you into submission. Negging plants doubt, creates emotional imbalance, and makes you question your value, Stern says. Over time, that confusion can chip away at your self-esteem, making you more susceptible to seeking validation from the very person who is undermining you. That's why, when done intentionally, negging is an emotionally manipulative behavior. It convinces the receiver that no one else will want them. Stern says that negging is hard to notice because we've normalized emotional manipulation in the name of playfulness or game. If you think you're being negged, trust your gut and open a dialogue. Tell them that a comment didn't sit right with you, or ask if it was a joke that simply didn't land. Stern says, if the other person is receptive, they'll adjust. But if they're dismissive, it's time to set a boundary. Walk away if it's someone new. And if it's an established relationship, tell them, I want us to be able to joke, but not in ways that hurt me, Stern says. If it continues, rethink the relationship and remember that you deserve better. That's Word of the Week, Negging by Cassie Hurwitz. Up next, we have Wally Lamb on fatherhood, addiction, and the masculinity crisis. The father of three sons and the author of three Oprah's book club picks knows a thing or two about developing male minds, by Charlie Burlock. Wally Lamb became a father and a writer simultaneously. He began working on his first book in 1981, the year his first son was born. He began writing his most recent novel, The River Is Waiting, between shifts caring for his newborn granddaughter. With my other books, I made the main character my age, he told Oprah in his recent Starbucks interview. But this character is my kid's age, and so I started with that, and I just began worrying about him. Like many of Lamb's male characters, the protagonist of The River Is Waiting makes worrying easy. Corby is a recently laid-off father of twin toddlers who mismanages his stress with booze and benzos until his addiction culminates in an unimaginable tragedy and a hefty prison sentence. Much of the book takes place behind bars, a setting Lamb knows intimately from his time teaching writing to incarcerated women and visiting his own incarcerated son. Drawing from Lamb's own experience, The River Is Waiting is at once a damning critique of rampant injustice hiding within the prison system and an empathetic case study in the rampant despair hiding within so many men. We caught up with Lamb in the days before his book's publication and in the midst of the so-called crisis of masculinity to discuss what he's learned from 44 years of raising and writing complicated men. Question. You've said in writing this book that you learned to be angrier, that you were aware of systemic injustice and racism in the carceral system before, but that this book helped you to invest in your rage and make something out of it. A lot of your writing focuses on the disastrous outcomes of male anger, from school shootings to violent alcoholism to self-harm. How have you been able to tap into an anger that feels more productive and communal? Lamb. I think this goes way back to my coming of age in the 1960s. I was an undergraduate at the University of Connecticut from 1968 to 1972, during the Vietnam War, the civil rights fight, and so forth. That lit fire in me, and the fire has never gone out. I was more complacent during the 80s and 90s, but the fire stayed lit. For a lot of my fellow baby boomers, it hasn't. They've started swinging more conservative, and that's their right. But I'm still scratching my head and thinking, yeah, but how about when we used to fight against injustice? Question. We're seeing that with the younger generation as well. There's a lot of talk these days about the male loneliness epidemic and the mainstreaming of extreme misogyny online. As someone who is focused intently on the developing male psyche, both as a writer and as the father to three sons, what do you think is driving these trends? Lamb. It's probably a little too easy to say the internet, but I see in myself a sort of addiction to things like Facebook. If I'm up in the middle of the night and can't sleep, I'll grab the phone. I know a lot of young guys are not only in their phones looking at that kind of stuff, but also listening to podcasts. I think people villainize Joe Rogan, but there are much darker podcasts and voices out there, and, you know, if you're dissatisfied or if you're isolated, and you're male, particularly male, I think then it's easier to grasp on to that kind of thinking or that kind of habits. Question. That's what's so compelling to me about the protagonist of The River Is Waiting. He doesn't fit the stereotypes. He's liberal, he's married, he's a loving father, and yet he still finds himself overcome by loneliness, despair, and eventually addiction. What inspired you to focus on these themes? Lamb. I have had a little bit of experience in terms of addiction, particularly to alcohol. I was a late bloomer, so it did not become a problem for me until my 50s, and I drank alcoholically for about maybe 10 years. I would convince myself at the beginning of my writing day that drinking would get the wheels turning, which was not the case, as I understood once I got sober. Luckily, with a lot of help, I was able to pull out of that black hole that I was starting to go down. And I will always be very grateful for that. Question. What do you think that people get wrong about addiction that you wanted to get right in your portrayal of it in this book? Lamb. A lot of people in recovery circles say that if you are an alcoholic, you have the gene for alcoholism. I think that's one way to become an alcoholic. But with me, it was more of a situational thing. I was going through a particularly hard time in my life. My parents were elderly and infirm, and I was kind of like the go-to guy. And at the same time, I was teaching full-time, and we had just adopted a little boy, our nephew, who became our son. He was a kid who had mental illness and addicted birth parents as well. So I was balancing that, and I was trying to write a third novel at the same time. It just got so hard for me, and I didn't know what else to do. So I started drinking. It was a lonely thing. I was never a bar drinker. I would drink by myself. I didn't have to hit a terrible bottom to get out of it, so I don't think I have that alcoholic gene. I think addiction comes from situations, too. Question. In your conversation with Oprah, you mentioned that your adopted son spent time in prison. Would you be willing to speak a bit more about that and how it shaped your representation of the carceral system in this novel? Lamb. I don't want to say too much because he should have his privacy too, but I will say that he followed in his birth parents' pattern in terms of drug addiction, and he began to find illegal ways to get the money to fuel that. He ended up in prison, and I used to visit him. There's a part in the novel when the protagonist, Corby, says he thinks that women are just stronger than men because it's women who come and visit the prisoners. Whether they are grandmothers who are taking care of the kids and wearing their convalescent home pinafores, or girlfriends, or so forth, it's women who show up. That was my experience when I would go to visit our son. Often, I'd be one of the few men who went into the visiting room. Usually, it was another father. And sometimes, I would be the only guy in the visiting room. I don't think it's because men are necessarily cold. They don't necessarily detach from loved ones who are male. I think so many of men's problems come down to fear. It's not that women don't live with fear, but that they can more easily voice that fear. Of course, I'm talking generalizations, but I think that often men feel that they have to close down. So if I'm the guy sitting at the bar, and I'm on my sixth or seventh beer, and somebody else in the bar pisses me off, I don't take it inward. I punch him in the face. Whereas women tend to go more inward and talk about their fear and their emotions with other people, men sometimes keep it stuck within themselves until there's an explosion. Question. You capture that buildup and that explosion with so much empathy and grace in this book. I am so grateful that it is out in the world. What is one thing that you hope readers will take away from The River Is Waiting? Lamb. I try not to direct the readers too much. When I'm writing it, it's mine. And when it's published, then it goes out in the world, and it belongs to people who want to read it. But if I had to hope for one thing, it would be that readers might get angry too. If they've been complacent, but they might get angry at the abuse of power against the powerless. And that was Wally Lamb on Fatherhood, Addiction, and the Masculinity Crisis by Charlie Burlock. Up next, 5 rest rituals for an instant recharge, no naps required. Different tasks require different forms of restoration, and sleep is just one piece of the puzzle. By Nicola Jane Hobbs. On some Sunday afternoons, I'll have a nap on the sofa. It's taken me years to be in a place where I can do this, where I feel safe enough to do this, where I feel compassionate enough to do this. But napping isn't the only form of rest that can reinvigorate and restore us. More than that, it's important we find the right type of rest that replenishes the resources we're depleting through our specific activities and stressors. Because different tasks use different resources, we need different forms of rest to recover from them. The practices and strategies we find restorative are going to be unique for each of us. We all have different stress capacities and recovery resources, and our temperaments, cultural conditioning, childhood experiences, and trauma histories will influence what we find restorative. For example, for some of us, gaming, watching TV, or scrolling through our phones in the evening may feel overstimulating and contribute to bedtime procrastination, while for others, the psychological detachment these activities offer may be restful and restorative. Part of my research for The Relaxed Woman, Reclaim Rest and Live an Empowered, Joy-Filled Life, involved asking women how they rested and what kinds of experiences they found restful. From this, 10 types of rest emerged: physical, mental, sensory, emotional, social, spiritual, playful, creative, ecological, and altruistic, along with a plethora of rest rituals under each type for us all to explore. Here are the top rest rituals that can have an overwhelming impact toward your own relaxed woman journey. Let your choices be messy and compassionate and imperfect. 1. Foster safeness-inducing thought patterns. Our thoughts are one of the most common sources of stress. Stress-inducing thoughts, which are often related to scarcity, self-criticism, and the anticipation of something going wrong in the future, trigger the body's stress response. Once we're in this state of stress, our threat sensitivity increases, and we're more likely to experience stress-inducing thoughts, keeping us trapped in a spiral of anxious thinking and chronic stress. We can escape this spiral by identifying our habitual stress-inducing thoughts and meeting them with thoughts that send a signal to our nervous systems that we are safe. These safeness-inducing thoughts are rooted in self-acceptance and self-compassion. For example, two of my habitual stress-inducing thoughts are, I haven't got time, and I've got so much to do. Now, whenever I notice them pop into my head, I meet them with compassion, pausing, placing my hand on my heart, and silently saying, take your time. There's no rush. 2. Take sensory breaks. When we're in sensory-rich environments, weddings, parties, offices with open floor plans, it can be helpful to take a short sensory break every so often to protect ourselves from sensory overload. This might be as simple as going to the toilet for a couple of minutes or stepping outside where there aren't as many people. If you feel that sensory stimulation in your workplace is overwhelming, it might be helpful to speak with your manager about making sensory adjustments. These could range from getting some noise-canceling headphones to help you focus, to having a more flexible schedule so that you can take regular sensory breaks. 3. Engage in deep acting. Emotional labor is unavoidable for many of us. We frequently have to display certain emotions and hide others in order to provide a good service in our work and take care of our loved ones. There are two main ways we carry out emotional labor: surface acting, faking the expected emotional expressions, and deep acting, connecting with our values to cultivate genuine feelings that match the emotional expressions that are required. For example, if it's way past my son's bedtime, and he isn't settling and I feel frustration rise, I connect with one of my core values, gentleness. When I do this, I sense my nervous system calm, notice my voice soften, and feel a deep sense of compassion awaken for how hard he must be finding it to fall asleep. While surface acting depletes our emotional resources, research has found that deep acting can be protective of our well-being. Next time you feel yourself performing emotional labor, see if you can connect with your values to awaken the feelings you want to express. 4. Establish a daily playtime. When I was at school, playtime was an essential part of the day. We had 3 breaks each day of completely unstructured time when we were free to play games, have fun, and hang out with friends. At some point on the way to adulthood, playtime got squeezed out, but we can bring it back in simple and healing ways. This will be different for each of us, depending on our schedules and responsibilities, but I like to spend 5 minutes at the end of my lunch break playing before I get back to work. Recently, I've been enjoying juggling, but I've also been through phases of playing with handstands, doodling, and reading a few pages of a fun fiction book. What is something fun you could do in your daily playtime? 5. Try beauty hunting. When we're in a state of stress and our brains are wired toward threat detection, we have to consciously look for the beauty in our lives. This is what Jennifer Pasteloff, author of On Being Human, calls beauty hunting. Often when we begin this practice, we discover that beauty is all around us, hidden in the simple things we usually take for granted. The delicate pattern in a leaf, the soft sound of birds in the distance, the reflection in a puddle, the elderly couple walking in front of us holding hands. You might like to spend a minute beauty hunting now. Look around and let yourself be drawn to the beauty that is all around you, and notice how your body responds. Again, that was 5 rest rituals for an instant recharge, no naps required, by Nicola Jane Hobbs. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kathy Bostrom, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.